You are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because I have up in here three members of the group The Conservatives, who are also Teachers Edition, and I have a fourth member on the phone. So we have almost the complete group up in here right now. And for the whole show, they'll be talking about the history of their group, and we'll be playing their records. You'll get to hear the story and the music, so you should definitely keep tuned. So I thought we could start off with each person who is up in here now introducing yourselves. Carl, I guess you can go first because you're on the phone.
All right, Carl Boyd.
Okay, and who else is here?
John Jones.
Farnell Jenkins.
And Paul Kelly.
Okay, and the group ultimately, there were five members in the group, is that right?
Right, yeah.
What was the name of the fifth member?
Claude Bassett. He's not here tonight. He wasn't able to be here tonight.
Okay, but you pretty much had the same lineup throughout your whole career, which is unusual. Like, most groups had a million people come in and out of the group. So I thought we could get started talking about, first of all, what are you guys all from the same part of Chicago?
Well, I'm from the suburbs, Blue Island area.
Okay.
South suburbs. And we all went to school together in Chicago.
Okay. So are you guys mainly a South Side area?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. And what's unusual, like a lot of groups I talk to, they're high school groups, but you guys all met in college, is that right?
That's correct.
So what's the story? Where did you guys meet?
Well, I'm kind of the historian on that. I played the basketball team with Claude, played baseball with Farnell and John, and I was in the choir with Carl. So I guess you could say I'm the linchpin of
it. So, and that was all in college you're talking about.
Yes, that's
what college did you guys go to?
It was Chicago Teachers College at the time. It's changed names about four or five times, but now it's Chicago State University.
Okay. And where is it located?
95th and King Drive.
Okay.
But when we were there, it was 69th and Stewart.
Okay.
Overson High School was located.
Okay. So you guys, did you all sing before you met, or how did it work out?
Well, I've been singing, I'm in church, I guess, most of my life. Well, my dad was a preacher.
Okay.
Actually, I sang in church, and John's dad also was a preacher, so he has that church background also.
Okay.
And I had a little different background. My dad sang opera and a group called the Southern Airs, dating back to the mid-40s.
Okay.
And all my brothers and sisters sang, and my brother-in-law, some will know as Jody Christian, who just had a salute to here in Hyde Park last weekend.
Okay. So so you guys weren't singing in groups in high school, then? You just kind of, were you just sang in church pretty much? Carl, do you have a similar experience?
Well, actually, I can tell you that we started after the punt of no return.
Okay.
They didn't tell you how we really started. I mean, all of us did a smattering of singing.
Okay.
But we played intramural football at Chicago Teachers College.
Okay.
They allowed me to kick because our backs were to our goal line.
Okay.
When I kicked the punt, Paul Kelly ran downfield to make sure that he would get the person who received the punt, except I kicked it behind us. And when they turned around, there was no return because nobody could punt the return that was behind us. After the game, as we walked to the locker room, either John or Farnell started singing It's All Right by The Impression.
Yeah.
And we all joined in. And the rest is history.
So was that the first time you sang together, or you had been singing together before? What had happened?
I think that was actually the first time we had actually
all sang together.
As a group. Yeah, we went into the locker room and we kept singing, and the echo sounded so good. We were like, oh, okay, maybe we should give this a shot, you know. And of course, at Chicago Teachers College at the time, it was not unusual for doing breaks in the lunchroom for guys to sit around and kind of
you know, harmonize and sing some of the old songs. So we did some of that too while we were there in college. But that day, I think, kind of suggested to us that maybe we had a little something going there.
Right. Okay, and then so you guys were telling me that after you sort of accidentally started singing together in the locker room, you were asked to do a pep rally. Is that right?
That's correct. On the way to the locker room, I'm sure, because I'm sure Emma didn't come into the locker room. Emma Collins Redmond now, who's a High Parker, was the editor of the school newspaper, Temple. She heard us singing and asked if we would consider singing as part of an upcoming pep rally.
Okay. Do you remember what you sang at the pep rally?
Don't have a clue.
So one thing I didn't ask you is what year was this happening in?
It was the spring of 1964. Seems like yesterday.
Okay. So did you guys start like officially singing together after that? You started meeting up and singing together after that experience?
Yes. I think we were asked to sing at a number of, or at least a few, school events.
Janet Sledge.
Meetings. What was that, Carl?
Janet Sledge.
Oh, right. We'll let you tell that story.
It was all because of Janet Sledge and George Rock Wilson, who discovered us because Janet gave a party or two.
So they were students at school with you?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Well, you know, there were fraternities and sororities. And so we got on, some people start on the Chitlin circuit, and we started on the Greek letter circuit.
Okay. So you guys started singing different, like, fraternities at the school. And so did you guys come up with a name then? Did you guys come up with a name, the Conservatives, back then?
Yes, you were conservative.
Well, I think it was kind of our approach to music. We did some pop things, some soft stuff, and we kind of perceived ourselves as being kind of on the conservative side.
Okay.
So that was the name that we came up with that we thought would speak to what we were doing initially.
So when you were doing that, were you billed as the Conservatives on these shows too? Like, you came up with that name originally?
Yeah, on the Greek letter circuit and the parties and all that. Yeah, we were called Conservatives. Yes.
Okay. And I think you had mentioned before, like, you guys also dressed like you had the Ivy League style. Is that part of it too?
Yeah.
Okay. We were Ivy Leaguers.
Yeah.
Not Gaussian.
No, we didn't do the Gaussian thing. Yeah.
Okay.
We're too cool for that. Yeah.
So when did you guys all graduate from college?
Well, I graduated August of 1964.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I lived across the street on Normal Parkway. What's that? Normal Parkway North. And I went to Wilson, transferred from Wilson, went next door to Teachers College, graduated from Teachers College, went next door to begin teaching at Park Elementary School, and at the same time, I was staying across the street.
Okay. And did you guys all graduate? You didn't all graduate the same year, did you?
No, I was in 1966.
Okay.
And I was in April of 65.
And Carl, when were you?
64.
Okay. So, and after you guys graduated, did you all became teachers, is that right?
Right.
That's correct.
Right.
And did you guys continue to meet up and sing with each other for that time?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And it was a few years before you actually ended up recording. And your first record you recorded was called That's All, and it you got associated with sort of the Afro arts things that were happening in Chicago. I'd like to get into that, but before I do, let's play that record. So
let me just tell you that happened on. We recorded that on stage in a theater at 39th and Drexel, the Afro arts theater.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that after. I'll play the record. I just want to give the listeners an idea of what kind of music we're talking about.
Okay.
So we'll play the record and then we'll be back with the Conservatives. So this is their very first record. That's All.
How I may not always be there when you want me.
Okay, that was just the Conservatives with their very first record titled That's All. And if you're just tuning in, we have up in here three of the Conservatives and one other one on the phone talking about the story of their group and their music. So, first of all, that record I just played, who was singing lead on the record?
That was me, John Jones.
Okay, and who was singing the bass part?
That was Paul Kelly.
Okay, and then the other members were just singing like different tenor parts.
Of course, you might want to make note that last very emotional expression of "That's All" the tag, that was Farnell, Farnell Jenkins.
Okay, so before I played the record, we had just talked about how you guys had all gotten out of teachers' college between like 64 and 66, and you guys were singing together. But that record didn't come out until, do you remember when it came out, around 68, something like that?
I think it was 68 or 69, maybe, when we recorded that at the Afro Arts Theater.
So can we go back and talk about the events that happened, like how you got involved and what that was? So you guys, were you actually ever doing shows before that? Like, were you doing local talent shows or anything after you graduated from college?
Well, we did the party circuit and all that, and then in about 68, we did the name change from Conservatives to Teachers Edition, and it was around that time that we really started thinking, well, we better get into these clubs, because at that time, the nightclub was kind of popular, that scene was popular with local talent, and we sang at a lot of the clubs, 68, 69, 70.
Okay, but that record still came out when you were the Conservatives, right?
Right, we were, yeah.
And so that record, when it came out, you had gotten involved with the Afro Arts Theater. Right. Can you describe what that was and how you got involved with it?
I'm not sure how it came about.
Well, it was one of those things, I think, where we knew that they every Friday night there was a performances at the Afro Arts Theater.
Okay.
A group called the Pharaohs were the sort of the host group, and they were doing a lot of great things. And they asked us, you know, if we wanted to sing. Oh, we asked them, probably.
So where was the Afro Arts Theater?
39th and Drexel, 3900 South Drexel in Chicago.
Okay.
40th and Drexel.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Some may remember it as the old Oakland Square. show. I'm sure Carl does.
Right.
Not too far from each other. Families.
So were you
pretty close?
So were you going to the theater to watch shows? I mean, once in a while, and then they asked someone, like one of the pharaohs asked you to be in the show, or how did it happen?
I think we probably had gone to there a few times, but we knew them.
And, okay.
You know, I think we probably talked our way onto the stage.
Okay. And can you talk more about what the theater was and what the purpose of the theater was? And I know Phil Coran was behind it too,
yep.
Right?
Exactly.
Can you give a little bit of the history? Carl, do you know some of it?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we might do is kind of frame the time.
Okay.
Considering that we were at the Afro Arts Theater after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
We were singing at a time when revolutions were going on throughout the United States of America, and the Afro Arts Theater was a theater where a lot of people were coming into the revolution. We were changing our diets.
Okay.
We were becoming more health conscious. And Phil Coran had formerly played with Sun Ra.
Okay.
So the Pharaohs were kind of a revolutionary band with some of the best talent in the United States of America. Don Lee was the resident poet, and of course he became Haki Madhubuti. And there was a point at which part of the group, I guess the guys will tell you more about this, in 1970 when we went to California to find a manager, part of the Pharaohs went to California with Maurice White, who was also conservative. He wasn't a member of our group, but he played drums for Ramsey Lewis. So it was kind of surprising when we went to California with the revolutionary members of the Pharaohs, and they'll tell you more about that. But it was a kind of a gathering place. As a matter of fact, many young militants came to see our show and to celebrate our blackness.
Yeah,
that's what a lot of that was about.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get an idea of sort of what type of things went on in the show. Like, I know I interviewed another group, the Sounds of Black, that did shows with you guys there, and I know the Spencer Jackson family were part of that scene. I know there were dancers too, so it wasn't just singing groups, right?
Oh, definitely. I think we were almost the only singing group for a while.
Okay. And so it was more all about sort of celebrating, like, African-American culture, and sort of was Afro-heritage was one of the words that was, like, they used, right?
Yes.
So were you into that, too, before you became a part of the actual show there? Or did you get more involved with it once you sort of joined the show?
We were basically focusing on trying to develop the group and our started, you know, really zero in on a career.
Okay.
And we were looking for any.
So it was an opportunity for you.
Any opportunity to perform and to expose what we had as far as our collective talent was concerned.
Okay.
We wanted to take advantage of it, but we were also very much in tune with the philosophical views and that whole revolutionary spirit that existed at that time.
Okay.
So it made it a natural thing for us.
Yeah, that's also one of the things that made it funny that you were called the conservative. This is almost like it doesn't go along with the times.
Yeah.
So so how long were you part of the show before you ended up cutting a record?
I'm not sure.
Probably a few months, I suppose. We went there on Friday nights for quite a while, and we also went to African arts festivals and performed, you know, with the Pharaohs on a couple of occasions. And I think at that time we were looking for anything that to promote the group. So I wrote a couple of things. Farnell wrote a couple of songs, and that's how that's all came about. And we asked the Pharaohs, you know, to accompany us on it, and they, you know, agreed to do that. That's how we ended up recording that at the theater.
So you recorded the song live, yeah, at the theater, yeah, with the Pharaohs playing live.
Right. In fact, that sax line is being played by Don Myrick.
Okay.
Who became well known as one of the great, alto sax players in the business.
Did you do it in pretty much one take even?
Not quite.
No. Okay.
But that was our label. What was that?
It was a Bonic Sound.
Bonic Sound, yeah, that was our own label, yeah.
So you not only, you recorded it live in the theater and you put it out yourselves pretty much on the Ebonic Sound label.
Yeah.
It says on the record, produced by the Pharaohs. I don't know if you guys had more of a hand in it or how much of a role they had in it.
Well, I think at that time we just reviewed it as a cooperative venture.
Okay.
And we appreciated what they did to the point that that wasn't an issue.
Okay. And so I'd like to talk about the B side of the record now, which is interesting. I don't know if I don't think I'll have time to play it, but if we have time at the end, I'll play it. But let's talk about it. So on the record, the B side is called the Crunching Song, but it's not supposed to be the Crunching Song. Is that right?
That's right.
So what is it supposed to be?
Grunchin'.
So what's a grunchin'?
Grunchin were a little green and orange people, and that comes, of course, from one of the many gimmicks that Herb Kent came up with. Herb helped us a lot along the way. We'll have to talk hopefully a little more about that a little later. But Herb, one of his skits involved social unrest and conflict between the green Grunchins and the orange Grunchins, and that was kind of in keeping with the times. And each group represented the predominant the racial.
So the orange Grunchins were the white people, right?
No, the orange were the
white. Okay.
How do you spell Grunchin, John?
It's G-R-U-N-C-H-U-N.
It's I-O-N-S.
I-O-N.
I always
wondered.
Yeah.
You always wondered about that, didn't you?
So was it? Did they just make a mistake when they pressed the record? Is that probably?
Yeah, that was an error. Yeah. Right.
So yeah, like it's funny because people like me, when you know I wasn't around then, and I play the record, I'm like, what are they talking about? So now I have an explanation. So you released one more record under the name The Conservatives on your own Ebonic Sound label, and I will play it, and then we can talk some more. So this is the second Conservatives record, and this is called Who Understands?
People say, just do the best that you can.
Okay, you are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Conservatives with their second record titled Who Understands. And if you're just tuning in, we have three members of the Conservatives up here in the studio and one on the phone talking about the history of their group. So that was the second record you guys released. Who was singing lead on that record?
I was singing lead.
Okay, so Farnell Jenkins was singing lead on that record. And it also had the Pharaohs backing. You could tell it was the Pharaohs. They have a distinctive sound. So one thing I never asked is, so did your records get any play on the radio here in Chicago?
Not as much as we wanted.
Okay.
Not quite as much as Motown.
Yeah.
Atlantic.
so and you said Herb Kent was a fan of you, is that right?
He
helped you out.
Yeah, and Herb would always do promotional things, and we got started to go around with him on some of his promotions and all that, and he kind of liked the group, and eventually, as a matter of fact, he introduced us. After we changed the name, he introduced us to Willie Mitchell down in Memphis, and the first record we released off of the things that we did down there got more airplay than I think any other that we had.
Okay, so while you were the Conservatives, did you mainly did shows and toured with the Pharaohs, is that right?
Well, yeah, just
that, but I think one of the major things at the time that we were quite proud of, and I'm not sure stand corrected, we were in school with Daddy O'Daly's daughter, Pat Daly, and we did a Christmas show for Breadbasket, I believe the fundraiser was
called, okay,
at DeSalvo High School on King Drive. Well,
was it Operation Breadbasket you're talking about? Okay,
I'm sorry, Dunbar. Right, and it wasn't even King Drive then, by the way, guys.
It was South Park. Park, yeah.
Right, I get it straight. But that was quite an effort, I think, on our part, and it was our production, and I think Red Saunders' band played with the orchestra at the time. At the time, they were doing most of their work at the old Regal Theater.
Okay, but you didn't? Did you ever tour as the Conservatives? Did you ever leave Chicago?
No, not
okay.
Really.
So pretty soon after that, you changed your name to the Teacher's Edition. So what's the story with that?
John.
Yeah, that, I'll tell you how that came about. We were all teaching, obviously, and we were again known as the Conservatives, and I would occasionally allow my students to take a break and listen to music. And one of my students, while they were doing their work, and one of my students was busy doing his work, and then suddenly he stopped. He looked at me, and I thought he had a question about something in the assignment. And he said, "Mr. Jones, I got it. I said, "What is it?" He said, "Teacher's Edition." He said, "That's what you should call your group." and I, you know, brought it back to the group, and we all liked it. That's how that started.
Did you get a name, John?
On that one assignment.
What did he say about the name?
He described how, a student in...
I mean, what did he say about the student's name?
Oh,
the student's name?
Do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name.
I just wanted to say that it's a good thing that the student did that, because I can't imagine how long we would have lasted as the Conservatives on the Ebonics label. That could have later been very dangerous.
Good point.
So you guys changed your name to, and I didn't, were you all music teachers, or did some of you teach music and some of you teach other subjects? Or what?
I taught music
okay.
at the old Forestville Upper Grade Center.
Okay.
My first teaching assignment, yeah.
I was a teacher of music also. Well, I taught in the public school system for maybe about 25 years.
Okay.
And for most of those years, I taught music at Park Elementary School, Marconi School on the west side, and at Brennan on the south side here.
Okay. But you didn't all teach music, right?
No.
Okay.
John was quite the artist, and still quite the artist, and taught art.
Okay. And Carl, what did you teach?
Science.
Okay. And so you guys made reference to the fact that you changed your name to the Teacher's Edition, but before you recorded, you went out to L.A., is that right?
Actually, had we recorded already?
But not as the teacher's edition.
I meant before you recorded as the teacher's edition, you went to the West Coast, to try to get. Were you trying to get a deal? Is that what was happening?
Well, actually, our first trip of note was to the opposite coast, to the East Coast, to New York, and we we managed to get kicked out of Johnny Carson's apartment building. But
so how did that? What's the story behind that? You just went to you guys just went to New York to try to see what's up, try to get a deal. What happened?
So we were trying to have somebody discover us.
Okay.
So Ed Sullivan, we had gone to the apartment complex where he lived, and also Johnny Carson's residence, big building. And the reason I'll never forget the date, it was the date that the Jets beat the Baltimore Colts. Mm-hmm. So we were down in the vestibule waiting for Johnny Carson to get back from the game. So we were down there singing, entertaining all the tenants of the building.
What day was that?
It was on a Saturday.
What year?
I don't recall the
December
exact date.
It was 69, right?
Right. December was our Christmas break.
The Joan name is
right.
So you went to New York and just hung out in the lobby of Johnny Carson's building, hoping he would walk in and hear you sing.
Yeah, but please, hello.
Hello.
Please understand, the singing in the lobby was a significant step up. Until then, we had sung in some of the best echoed restrooms in the best hotels in the United States.
So you guys just went around to other places in New York just trying to get discovered.
And labels. Yeah.
And did you do it for the winter break? Is that just the period that you did it for?
Look, we were out there for maybe about a week.
Yeah.
Or a few days.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah.
And then you came back home and just went to work again.
Oh yeah.
And then you guys went to the West Coast. Do you remember what year you went to the West Coast?
Absolutely.
1970.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. That's correct. Was it summer break?
Yes.
Okay. Break. So what did you guys do on the West Coast?
Carl.
Carl.
Oh. Actually, we were looking for a manager.
Okay.
And this is one of the great stories that we like to tell, because some of the guys from the Pharaohs, as well as a young lady we knew whose name was Shirley Scott, and some others had gone to get Jim Brown to help them form a new group.
Okay.
They even offered to play behind us. And we told them that we were looking for a manager, and by the way, what are you going to call yourselves? And they said, Earth, Wind, and Fire. So they did all right.
So I don't understand, what was the connection with Jim Brown? Like he was trying to put out their music, or what was the story there?
Just helping them, introduce them to folks, and he was a great advocate of what they stood for. I don't know, guys, he might have known Maurice White already, I don't know.
Because I know he had a couple record labels and even put out music in the 60s.
Okay.
But you guys, he didn't put out music on you guys, right? You were just there when Earth, Wind, and Fire got discovered, that was what you're saying. So what happened with you guys in the West Coast?
We did some auditions and played in a couple of clubs.
Okay.
And some of the guys from the group that became Earth, Wind, and Fire, joined us and played. It was basically a live audition.
Okay.
At the hot spots in L.A. Mm-hmm. And, it was a great experience. And we eventually, again, had to return and go to work.
Okay.
So I recall in particular that we had a gig in L.A. and we needed a band. So we knew Verdine from Chicago.
Right,
and
right.
So we asked Verdine if he could maybe get a guitarist and maybe a percussionist and help us get together on some music and do the gig with us. And he consented. And but of course, this was before Verdine became the Verdine of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
So you guys, how long were you in L.A. for?
Oh my gosh, we were there The first time.
A couple weeks?
It was a
longer?
A little longer. We talked to my family. One of the experiences that I remember, we went to a club called Peyton Place on 39th Street.
Right, in Weston.
And I'm sure will remember that the coincidentally, there was a Peyton Place here in Chicago on 39th Street here in Chicago.
Okay.
And there was a group there called the Sinceres.
Yeah, they're from Kansas City, right?
Kansas City,
yeah.
You got it. And they were kind enough to allow us to sing between their sets, and I think they may have even played for us, I'm not sure, so that we could then tell those folk whom we may have talked with earlier in the day, hey, look, come to the Peyton Place and you can hear us sing. Some may not recognize the name Sinceres from Kansas City, but they will certainly recognize Bloodstone from London, England.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an interesting story just because the Sinceres record came out on an L.A. label. Because they cut a couple records as the Sinceres before they became Bloodstone. And I was always wondering, like, well, how did they get on an L.A. label?
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, they were out there the same time you guys were out there. So you guys actually went to L.A. twice, you were saying? Was it over the same summer break, or what was...
Well, we found ourselves in another lobby, I think. Sunset Strip, we're coming down the elevator, on an elevator in one of the taller buildings out there, and there was a very nice young lady on the elevator, asked us who we were and what we were there for. We said, well, we're a singing group, and she looked at us and kind of chuckled, and we quickly understood that, recognized that she didn't believe us.
So, okay.
We'll show you. We get down to the lobby, and we started singing. And there was a gentleman walking through the lobby carrying a carpet, as I recall. He discovered us, so we've been discovered several times. But this gentleman liked what he heard, apparently. He says, you know, I want to introduce you to my boss. So he took us to the an office, turned out to be the owner of not only that building on Sunset Strip, but seven or eight other buildings on Sunset Strip. And he said to us, you know, I like you, but I'm really not a musician, but I have a friend who's in music, and I'd like you to, I'm going to give you his address, and you call him, set up an appointment, and go out and meet him. And I'll let Carl.
Okay. Carl, do you want to finish the story?
Oh, Peter Duryea. That was when we met Peter Duryea, who was a son, I don't know how old you are, Bob, but that was Dan Duryea's son.
I'm not that old.
but I think that what they might have been talking about was after we got there, he said that he wanted to introduce us to someone as well who was going with A&M Records.
Okay, so who was that?
Paul Williams.
Okay.
And Paul wanted to write for us because he wasn't a singer, but he was going to go into A&M, and he would take us with him. But we were looking for a manager, and he wrote, four or five million sellers for the Carpenters.
Okay.
So we met some fantastic folks while we were there, and it did lead to USO shows.
Okay, so Paul Williams wanted to write for you, but you didn't go with him because you didn't have a manager yet, is that right?
We were really looking for a manager, for a connect. We wanted a record contract, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And he was, quote, just a writer,
unquote. So you were there twice, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, when were the two times you went there initially? Were they in both in 1970?
Yes, that's correct.
That's right.
The gentleman who introduced us to the owner of the building, the owner of the building, his friend was lived in
Beverly
Hills.
Oh, okay. That's.
And Ben Oakland is his name, and Ben has had a history of music dating back to Pinky Lee and wrote with Hammerstein and that kind of thing, and he had a contact with USO shows, and that's how we eventually, he became our manager, so we
And his name was Ben Auckland, you said?
Ben Auckland.
Auckland.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so he hooked you up and you started doing USO shows, is that right?
USO tours.
And this was before you recorded as a Teacher's Edition. This was still in the early 70s, 70, 71, around
right,
that time.
That's correct. That's correct. Some will know, of course, I'll Take Romance. Ben, that's just one of his many.
Okay.
I'll Take Romance.
Yeah. So
that's all I know, guys.
So you guys actually did USO tours. You went overseas. Did you go to Vietnam or that?
Yes, we did. So we did two tours, two USO tours, and on those tours we went to Okinawa, Guam, Korea, Thailand, Japan, and Vietnam.
Okay.
It was a fantastic experience.
Were both tours in 1971, or?
No, actually,
first tours.
You asked if we had made two trips to L.A.
Okay.
The second trip was to prepare for the USO
yes,
shows.
Yes, right.
And I think it was that trip that we sang at the celebration of the state of anniversary, 25th anniversary of the State of Israel.
Okay.
And that was through Ben. I had never seen so many people at one time in my life, running for the airport plane, and et cetera, the guys in our white suits, we were together. We could still run in those days, God bless. And then the trip after that was the trip to the West Coast.
Okay.
I'm sorry, to the first tour. That was in November of 1970.
Okay, and so and you just talked about all the places you went. Did anything crazy happen while you were overseas?
Yeah. Well, like Carl Mel is.
Well, that was the second tour. We went to Vietnam and to Thailand. Right. That was the second tour.
Right.
Okay. So,
Carl, he has a pretty vivid memory, so Carl can tell you.
So, Carl, you want to tell the story?
I don't know which one they're alluding to.
Okay.
There was one I don't remember at all, and the memory is in the not remembering.
Okay.
But I'll tell you one thing that did happen that was sobering at Camp Baker, and I think it might have been Da Nang, but we did a show after a 50-minute delay because they didn't want the black soldiers to attend the show.
Okay.
And we indicated that we were not going to perform if the black soldiers were not allowed in. And we ended up doing a show for virtually all blacks and Puerto Ricans. It was several months after that. I was at the Checkerboard Lounge.
Okay.
And a fella called me over and said that we saved them that night. And I didn't know what he was talking about, but in Vietnam, there was racial strife, and they didn't want the blacks and white soldiers to get together because they were threatening to hurt each other with some high-powered weapons. Now, since I didn't mention any names, I don't imagine I'm getting anybody in trouble, and there are enough stories post-Vietnam for people to know the validity of it. But when you ask about some crazy things, that to us was a pretty crazy thing.
Just that they wouldn't let the black soldiers attend your show.
Well, they proposed that they wouldn't. We were not going to do the show unless they did. And it turns out that after about a 50-minute delay, we did the show. They were admitted, but we didn't know the significance of it until we had returned home.
Okay, so. That's interesting. And when you did shows overseas, were the shows just you guys, or was it you guys and some other people on the show? What were the shows like?
The first tour, it was just the Teacher's Edition.
Okay.
The second tour, I believe, which was in March or February, late February, March of 71, there was a female vocalist, Jan Dome, that also took the tour.
So what type of stuff did you perform overseas?
Oh my. R&B stuff and some of the Motown kind of stuff. The soldiers were really, many of them said that saved them, you know, the music from back home, and they really loved the Motown stuff. So we put kind of a show together that included some of the popular songs, you know, that were being done back here, you know, the recordings and things.
And did you guys have choreography too? I always ask people this.
Yeah, we used to step on each other.
Okay, so
one of the things that I remember, and I'll just share briefly, in the second tour, we had a kind of a medley of songs where the bassoon was featured. I played the bassoon.
So you guys actually played instruments and sang, or
right? Farnell,
I played the keyboard.
Okay,
Kelly played bassoon.
Right. Right,
that was an interesting combination.
Yeah, right.
What does it take?
I didn't play very well then, but most people didn't even know what a bassoon was, so by the time they figured it out, we were finished. But it was a song that one of the songs was a song that Ben Oakland, our manager, had suggested, and we kind of a Broadway type song, and we went into from that to What Does It Take?
The Junior Walker song.
Junior Walker, right. Yeah. And I'm sure folk who know Junior Walker know the sax solo. Practice that sax solo.
you never heard that on a bassoon.
Yeah. Yeah. And were you guys ever in any like dangerous situations when you were overseas too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we were at a fire base.
Rakasan fire base.
Rakasan, yeah. And we were scheduled to do a show. They flew us in the Helis, the helicopters, out to the outpost where the fire base was located. And we were, you know, getting set up and everything and the sound together and getting ready to do the show. And suddenly, you could tell there was a change in the atmosphere, and somebody came to us and said, "Stop what you're doing and get into the bunkers."
Okay.
And we'll get back to you and let you know when you can continue to set up for the show. And how long was the delay? Maybe half hour or so.
I'm not sure, but I'm sure it was the same show where we'd gotten into the show. And these guns, these large howitzers, started going off, and the troops, they got a big kick out of the fact that we didn't realize what was going on. Keep in mind, we're trying to do that choreography that you just had on top of sandbags, so we already had some major challenges. And they were working on their range finding for the firing the following night, and et cetera, et cetera. But there's a couple of humorous events. Farnell will remember, I'm sure. In Thailand, we were told an incoming country were briefed on some of the philosophies and cultural points and things to do and not to do. You don't touch a child on the top of the head because that's considered the sacred part of the body, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the thing that stands out in my mind was that the Thai, if I've gotten this correct, if you were in an accident in a cab or whatever, as it turned out, the passenger would be held responsible because the philosophy was that vehicle would not have been in that location. You had a customer hiring them. And sure enough, Farnell and Claude show up one night just with this look on their face as if they'd seen a ghost or whatever. They were in a cab.
No, you don't.
I think one of them opened the door and another cab ran into the door. Well, the cab driver wanted to hold them responsible, and they didn't think that was fair, so they ended up being chased by these cab drivers. Fortunately, they ran into a club owned by an ex-serviceman who got them to the police station, and they worked through it. The cab driver probably still think he was responsible for it.
Yeah. So be it.
The other story that it was a personal one, though, we were in De La, which was the Vietnam, was the location of this beautiful resort city, the location of the military academies. Middle of the morning, and we're talking to this soldier. He's just one of those guys who could make anything funny. And he'd just gotten through explaining the difference between an incoming and an outgoing, and talking about, sure, I hear your car. And we hear this sound. Well, I'd only had one lesson. And I took off. And I, like I said, I could really run in those days. By the time they caught up with me to tell me that it was an outgoing, I was halfway under a bunk.
Okay.
Et cetera, et cetera. And I won't tell you what the service would tell me what would have happened to me if it had been an incoming in the position that they found me in.
Okay. So how long were you guys overseas for?
About first tour was what, maybe about 35 days?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And maybe the same length of time, much, for the second tour.
Right.
So the first one you said was November 1970, was that right? And when the second one was in 71 sometime?
Yeah, 71. Right.
So you guys take leave from your teaching jobs to do that?
Right, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then you came back to the U.S., and were you back in Chicago after the tours? And soon after that, you ended up actually recording as the Teacher's Edition. So what's the story behind that?
Well, Carl, why don't you talk about the Herb Kent connection?
We were very fortunate to have a good relationship with Herb Kent.
Okay.
And Herb had a good relationship with Willie Mitchell.
Okay.
So Willie obviously had discovered Al Green. And they had some young ladies, Ebony Webb, but Herb thought that they might be interested in a mature vocal group and felt that we fit the bill. So he was actually our high record contact, and after Willie met us, invited us to 308 Poplar Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee, and in the converted garage where the Hodges brothers made magic, they allowed us to come in and record there. Now, this was in 1973 when we were with High Records.
Okay, so between the period before that, when you came back, you were just sort of still performing and just looking for a record deal, is that right?
Well, now, here's what's interesting about the blessings that we had in terms of meeting folks. We were with Kurtom Records for a minute.
Okay.
With Eddie Thomas.
Okay.
And, of course, Curtis Mayfield and Eddie Thomas formed Kurtom Records.
Yeah.
And we were also briefly under management of Purvis Staples.
Okay.
So we met some great people.
How come you never ended up recording with those with like Stax or with Kurtom?
Hello? I thought someone else was fielding that question.
Oh, okay. Does anyone else want to answer that?
That's a difficult question to answer because I don't really know why we didn't.
Okay.
We did something with Eddie Thomas.
We did a couple of demos with Eddie.
Just never put it out.
I think it was one of those things where things were not moving.
Okay.
Because of the stair steps.
Singing what felt like a long time, trying along, and we were getting a little impatient, I think, and nothing was happening. So when Herb suggested that he could introduce us to Willie Mitchell, I think that we felt, hey, let's just drop everything and try this, you know.
Okay, so let me play the record, and we could talk some more. So you guys cut two records on High Records, which again, as you guys mentioned, is the label that put out Al Green and Ann Peebles and a lot of famous artists. I'm going to your first record was I Want to Share Everything and Sleepy People, is that right?
Yeah.
What was the intended A-side?
I Want to Share Everything with you.
Okay, well, I'll play the I Want to Share Everything side, and then we could talk some more. So this is the Teacher's Edition with I Want to Share Everything. Okay, you are tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Teacher's Edition with their first recording as the Teacher's Edition. That was called I Want to Share Everything. And if you're just tuning in, the Teacher's Edition, who are also the Conservatives, are up in here in the studio now and on the phone talking about their history. So that record we were just talking about, you guys actually went down to Memphis and recorded it with like the high rhythm, like Willie Mitchell's band. So one thing that's interesting is all of your records had like very talented, famous bands back in you. Like your first records had the Pharaohs, some of which became Earth, Wind & Fire, and your second record had Willie Mitchell's sort of high rhythm, who played on all the Al Green records, and they had that distinctive sound.
Yeah, the Hodges brothers were just fantastic.
So who wrote that record?
That record was written by a young man whose name is Don Bryant.
Okay.
He was a writer.
He wrote a lot of high things.
And, and I think he co-wrote I Can't Stand the Rain with Ann Peebles. And, so Don was a good writer. And then that was one of the songs that Willie said, okay, you guys listen to this, and I want you to try this one. Yeah.
So that record, it was, I'm pretty sure it was your biggest hit, right? Like in Chicago, that's the record
you played. I think, than any other, yes.
Okay. And so you cut a second record at High, It Helps to Make You Strong, and I Want to Be Loved. Did you cut that in the same session, or did you actually go back down to Memphis to record it?
That was the second trip.
Second trip, I believe we did.
Right. Okay. Right. So what do you remember? What were those all in 1973 those were cut?
I think so.
Yeah. Right.
73.
So were you guys doing shows in between in Chicago clubs and stuff?
Yeah, we did the club. By then we were doing a lot of things in the clubs.
Okay.
The High Chaparral particularly. We had some Green Bonnie and some of the others, but the Chaparral experience I was really memorable because we had a chance to open for a couple of true legends in the music industry, Duke Ellington and Lou Rawls.
Okay, when was that?
That was in 73.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I'll always remember that. But we opened for a lot of other acts at the time, Otis Clay and the Independence Emotions and other. We did a lot of stuff around the city, so we were a little busier around that time, 72, 73.
But you guys never actually toured outside of the USO tours, right?
We did a few college and
Ohio
university concerts, but not a regular tour.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, traditional tour, no.
And that record got some play in Chicago and nationally, I think. Do you know what other cities it was big in?
I was told that the St. Louis market, it was tested in the St. Louis market and was received pretty well. But I think we're in a situation where the London records, we were on the High label.
Which was distributed by London.
By London, and London was at that point putting all their effort behind Bloodstone.
Okay.
And they wanted us to kind of wait. They put us on hold.
Okay.
So they didn't really do a national distribution of those records.
Yeah, you could tell with the second record is very hard to find, so you could tell they didn't distribute the second record very well. So the second record, you went back to Memphis and recorded it, and it was called It Helps to Make You Strong and I Want to Be Loved. Which was the intended A-side of it?
Well, I don't remember if we looked at it as A or B or whatever. We just wanted to get some music and see if one of them would hit.
Okay.
But I think It Helps to Make You Strong got more.
It got more play, I believe. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to play. I like the I Want to Be Loved side a little better. So I'm going to play that record, and then we can talk some more. So this is the Teacher's Edition with I Want to Be Loved.
guess I'm a victim of loneliness. But why should this be?
Okay, you are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Teacher's Edition with the last record they recorded called I Want to Be Loved. And if you're just tuning in, we have members of the Teacher's Edition in the studio and on the phone talking about the story of their group. So that record came out also in 1973, is that right?
That's
yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
In 73, I believe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that record was actually written by Farnell, right?
Right.
And I think there wasn't somebody singing lead on that record? Farnell was singing lead on there.
Yeah.
On the other record I played, you guys kind of switch leads. Is that right? Or who was singing lead on the other one?
On the
I Want to Share Everything.
That was Claude.
Claude was singing lead. Okay. So. That record didn't, we were just talking about, it didn't get as much play just because London was, you said it was probably more promoting Bloodstone,
right,
and probably Al Green too at the time.
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So one thing that's interesting is a famous rock musician ended up covering that record in the 80s, right? What's the story with that?
Well, I'm not certain, but I was under the impression that Willie had sold his catalog to London Records.
Okay.
Somehow or another, Elvis Costello, being British, might have gotten it through.
Okay.
London Records. I'm not sure.
And John was saying that you actually read in some liner notes about how Elvis Costello found the recording.
Yeah, somebody put out a compilation that and it's just hard to tell whether it was accurate or not, you know, that he was actually going through some sample records, you know, trying to find something for an album. Mm-hmm. And he heard Farnell's recording of,
like, he found it in a store or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that.
So he was looking through some records in a store. I don't know if that's true or whether he was going through the catalog, the London catalog.
Yeah, right. For sure. In any case, Farnell is very happy about it. He's very happy.
And it's funny, you had told me that the liner notes that you were reading it described your group as hopelessly obscure.
Terminally
obscure. That's even better. So,
when we are alive.
Right? Yeah.
You should send Elvis this interview and he'll be like, "Now I know." So Farnell, did you like end up here? How did you find out that he had covered the song? Like, you didn't hear it on the radio, did you?
I didn't hear it. I got a royalty check. that was a good surprise. And I guess that must have been, what, maybe about 82.
Okay. You just started getting checks in the mail.
Right. so that was quite a blessing.
Okay. So that ended up being the last record that you guys recorded. So did you guys ever record? I know you said you cut a couple demos maybe at Kurt Tom. Did you ever record anything else either as the Conservatives or as the Teacher's Edition?
No, I'm sure we didn't.
Okay.
That was
was it? There might have been one or two things that we did while we were in Memphis that never really, you know, who we got to run to. I think that was one of them. Mm-hmm. But no, nothing significant. No.
Okay, so did you guys stay together as a group for longer?
74, I believe, was the last full year that we were working as a group.
Okay.
Still trying to make it, so to speak.
Okay. And then did you guys break up, or you just decided to sort of focus more on your careers and sort of stop doing music as much? Like, what happened?
I guess with me, and perhaps with other members of the group also, maybe there was a type of frustration that just kind of set in. And because we saw ourselves being the next Great Temptations, and I guess things weren't working out as we would have liked. And so it might have gotten a little frustrating, so we said, hey, well, this is about enough of this. Maybe we better do something else.
Yeah, that's a story with a lot of people I talk to after trying for so long. It's just, mm-hmm. It seems like diminished, like it's not worth as much trying. Especially, like, it was probably good that you stopped trying then, because the music industry just left Chicago around 75. And so, yeah, it would have been even harder if you continued to do it. Are any of you guys still involved with music, or have you done any music since you guys broke up?
Well, when we stopped singing, I thought it was my world had come to an end. It was radio stations I would listen to, acts I wouldn't go to see, and I guess my escape was to Chicago Musical College at Roosevelt, where I finally learned to play that bassoon.
Okay.
As a major and continued teaching, and maybe it was a blessing, or perhaps I won't say a curse, but given that we did have other options when things weren't going as fast or in the direction that we wanted to, and keep in mind we were raising families, so some of us, most of us, and so I think that went into the decision to get on with some other things that we'd kind of put on hold.
Okay, and you guys all continue teaching pretty much since.
Yeah,
like some of you are retired from that, but pretty much after the group broke up, you continued teaching.
Claude had an interest in acting.
Okay.
I'm sure he went to France and stayed a while in New York and did some things and taught himself to play the flute and kept a connection with show business, in quotes.
Is Carl still up?
Yeah, Carl's still there.
Hello,
Carl. Hi. So, and you continued to do teaching too, right? After the group broke up.
Well, interestingly enough, in August of 1997, I had the opportunity to work with John's faculty. He was assistant superintendent, Dalton Calumet, District 149.
Okay.
And they gave a new nomenclature to at-risk students and refer to them as learners with untapped potential.
Okay.
So I've had a career on working with teachers on how to deal with learners with untapped potential.
Okay. So I got to say thanks so much, guys, for coming down and being on the phone.
Thank you.
And telling your story. So any last words for the listening audience?
Well, I'd like to say, well, I continued working with music. I had written and produced a couple religious albums.
Okay, when was that?
Maybe in 80, maybe 80 and 82 with the Oakdale Covenant Church here in Chicago. And also did a children's album dealing with educational and social concepts.
Okay.
And I'm still presently, you know, involved in writing of music and all.
Okay. And John, do you have any other music things that you've done?
Well, over the years, I would occasionally sing at weddings.
Okay.
That kind of thing. And in the shower, of course.
Karaoke. Okay, well, thanks so much, guys, for coming on down. It's a great, great story you guys
have.
Thank
you, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi.
I don't know if we mentioned that we're all members of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity.
Okay.
That's important, Carl. I'm glad you
picked
up.
Yeah.
New prize.
Yeah. It is. Right on.
I think I saw it on your guys, on the cars of the group that they have this way.
Well, you got to represent, man.
So any last words for the listening audience?
Well, I thank you, first of all, Bob, for having us and for collecting the music of a terminally obscure group. it's been a pleasure. So thank you again.
Okay, well, thanks again. So this last record I'm going to play is the one we talked about before, which is mistitled The Crunching Song. It's actually The Gruncheon Song. So you can actually hear the story about the orange and green gruncheons in the song. So here is the conservative with the Gruncheon Song.
Say, Johnny Green, run it!